This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. It's 11 months in a row now, gang, that inflation has been falling. I just thought I ought to mention that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 13th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Good also was the news from the good people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics that consumer inflation in this economy continues to cool. The May Consumer Price Index came in this morning, as you've surely already heard. 4% from a year ago is how fast prices are going up. That is well down from the April reading and way down from the 9% inflation we were dealing with a year or so ago. But there is a rate of change challenge here because, as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, the more inflation cools, the harder it is to get it to cool off more.
We've gotten to the part of the inflation journey where the Fed is trying to squeeze the last bits of toothpaste out of the tube, inching closer to its target of 2% inflation. But it's slow going, says David Wilcox, an economist at the Peterson Institute and Bloomberg Economics.
The pathway ahead looks like it will take longer than anybody would prefer.
Why? Well, partly because when it comes to inflation, the most obvious and temporary problems tend to sort themselves out first. The pandemic and all the erratic consumer spending during its different phases, the initial shock to oil prices because of the war in Ukraine. Plus, economist Linda Hooks at Washington and Lee University says
the supply chain issues that everyone talks about.
Now that those have mostly subsided,
the Federal Reserve is working with some very broad tools, and they're aiming for a very small target.
Tricky, since a smaller target requires better aim. Jason Furman is an economist at Harvard.
What's left is both the continued tight labor market and the underlying inertia of wages and prices.
Underlying inertia. That's what's making this leg of the inflation journey so sticky. We've been here for so long that businesses have come to expect prices to rise every month.
It just gets built into everyone's planning. And they see their competitors doing that. Maybe they're giving wage increases that are a little bit larger than normal. And so it's just the self-fulfilling process.
And this phase can take a while because the economy is kind of like a food chain. First, manufacturers might feel price relief. That takes time to pass on to businesses, which takes time to get to you, the consumer, and the consumer price index.
And that process just ripples throughout the economy in a very slow-moving way.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Economist Alan Detmeister at UBS says inflation is shifting.
So it does look like we're getting inflation kind of focusing more narrowly on a few categories.
Like used cars and shelter.
Which generally means that inflation is easier to take down.
Detmeister thinks the Fed will reach its 2% target sometime next year. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Speaking of our inflation journey on Wall Street today, the phrase you're looking for is priced in. Traders do seem to be betting that when the Federal Reserve wraps up its interest rate meeting tomorrow, it's going to take a beat on raising those rates, at least for this meeting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know if you caught it at the end of Kristen's piece there, but one element of inflation in this economy is proving to be quite sticky. Used car prices are indeed down from their pandemic peak, but they're still up better than 40% from the before times. And as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, pretty much everything about owning a used car is a lot more expensive than it used to be.
The used car market has a crucial component: new cars. David Whiston follows the automotive industry for Morningstar.
It's all a giant, like a slinky. It all starts with that new vehicle getting sold. And then years later, that new vehicle will get sold as a used vehicle perhaps two or three times before it's scrapped.
Right now, that slinky has some kinks in it. Way fewer new cars have been produced in the past few years because of that shortage of microchips that started at the beginning of the pandemic. So there are not as many used cars for sale now.
And there's no used car factory is the way I like to explain it to people.
The low supply of used cars means higher prices. At Stivers Ford Lincoln in Waukee, Iowa, Scott Polite, the president, says used car prices can vary by $1,000 week to week, and his dealership has sold 15 to 20% fewer in the past year.
Just because of lack of inventory or lack of inventory that's priced right that will sell.
All of this is a particular challenge for the lowest earners, who are more likely to purchase used cars than new ones. Robert Frick is a corporate economist with the Navy Federal Credit Union. He says it's not just the cars that are getting more expensive.
If it were just used car prices, okay, that's bad. But if it were used car prices and higher insurance, that's worse. Now you add in much higher repair costs, it's become a real problem.
Frick says people should take a close look at the auto loans they're getting because the interest rates can really vary. He also says this is not the moment to buy your dream truck or SUV.
Buy less car. Buy a car that might not be the car you want, but is cheap and has as low mileage as you can afford.
Because as a classmate wrote in my high school yearbook, a dream car is really any car that runs. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Every so often in this job, you're scrolling through econ Twitter. Yes, that's a thing. And you see something like this.
Warning, the money supply is officially contracting. This has only happened four previous times in the last 150 years. Each time, a depression with double-digit unemployment rates followed.
And then it was followed by that grimace-faced emoji thing. And you think to yourself, huh. Of course, you should not believe everything you read on social media, especially when people are seeing signs of a recession around every corner. But if you do happen to take a look at the Federal Reserve's data on money supply, it is clearly doing something it hasn't done in a very long time. So we made some calls.
Back in the good old days, and say a few decades ago, money stock is viewed as a measure of economic activity.
Paulin Tien is an assistant professor of economics at George Washington University. And that thing she mentioned, money stock or money supply, it has two parts.
M1 basically covers cash.
You can think of M1 as cash and cash equivalents, all the dollars you use in everyday transactions.
If you want to go out and buy a cup of coffee, you can use cash, you know, write a check, or you can quickly move money from your savings account into your checking account and then write a check and pay for your coffee.
Those dollars are liquid, right?
Now, if we move up a level to M2, M2 includes things that are a little bit less liquid. So it includes everything that's in M1.
Cash, checking accounts, savings accounts.
It also includes money market accounts, certificate of deposits, slightly less liquid bank accounts.
You wouldn't, for instance, use the money you have in a CD to buy a cup of coffee. M2 includes all of those dollars plus all the cash in your bank account. That is what we're talking about when we're talking about money supply. And it has dropped by 5% over the past year. That's the first decline since the Fed started keeping track back in the 1960s. So there's that. But the economy today is not the economy of the 1960s.
These days, very few of us carry cash.
We've got credit cards and PayPal, Apple Pay too.
these new financial innovations really blurs the line on what counts as monetary assets.
And that gets us back to that tweet and what you really ought to understand.
I think that what we're seeing right now is not alarming.
Jeremy Pieger is a professor of economics at the University of Oregon.
I used to work at the Federal Reserve. You know, historically, they're, you know, maybe the single most important thing they did was regulate the quantity of money in the economy.
However, comma.
In the last 25 to 30 years, there's been a decreased emphasis on paying attention to certainly short-run movements in the quantity of money in the economy.
To be clear, the amount of dollars in the economy does still matter. But just seeing a drop in M2 does not necessarily portend economic doom the same way it might have when this was a more cash-based economy.
Like I said, I think most people do think that money matters. But shorter run movements, I think we're less convinced that we can reliably count on measures in the money supply to tell us a lot about what's going on.
In other words, money matters, but maybe nowadays other things matter more. Thanks again to Jeremy Pieger at the University of Oregon, Pao Lin Tian at GW. New York City is about to become the first city in this country where app-based delivery workers are going to get paid a minimum wage. In New York, that's more than 60,000 people. And starting next month, they're going to make almost $18 an hour before tips. By 2025, that'll bump to almost $20 an hour. Right now, because I know you're waiting for the comparison here, the city says delivery workers make, on average, about $7 an hour. Again, that's before tips. Minimum wage in New York, by the way, $15 an hour. Marketplace's Samantha Fields takes it from there.
For a while, Joshua Wood was making good money riding his bike around New York City delivering food.
In 2020 and parts of 2021, I was consistently pulling 25 to 30 an hour.
Wood is 25, and he's been doing deliveries for years now. He took a break today to talk to me from the streets of Midtown Manhattan. He says what he was able to make during the height of the pandemic was unusual.
Back then, customers were tipping a little bit higher. There was also a lot of venture capital coming in.
But these days, he says, he only makes about $10 to $15 an hour, including tips.
A lot of customers don't tip. A lot of the market right now is single meals, and those are usually only going to come with a tip of $1 to $2.
So he's thrilled that soon he'll be guaranteed to make at least $18 an hour. Vilda Vera Mayuga, commissioner of the New York City Department of Consumer and Worker Protection, is too.
This is going to make a huge difference for these workers who have been going over rain, snow, extreme heat. We had the air quality last week here in New York.
App delivery companies like Grubhub and DoorDash are not so happy about the change. Neither would Talk, but both sent statements warning of adverse or unintended consequences. James Parrott at the New School says there could be.
It is possible that customers will tip less generously, and it's also possible that the companies will increase the fees that customers have to pay.
But he says after New York passed a similar law for Uber and Lyft drivers in 2019,
it worked out to the benefit of the drivers, didn't have a noticeably adverse impact on passengers, and the companies are still profitable.
And even if delivery fees do go up, Andrew Wolf at the Workplace Justice Lab at Rutgers says people are likely to keep ordering in.
It is a luxury service, and people already don't really tip as much as they should.
So even if they tip less, he says, most delivery drivers will still make more than they do now. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The vibe is really rather overwhelming.
I mean, I'll try to keep it chill, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 145 points today, 0.4%, 34,212. Yeah, that's what people call me, chill, all the time. NASDAQ climbed 111 points, 0.8%, 13,573. The S&P 500 ticked up 30, about 0.7%, 43.69. Smith Fields was just telling us about delivery workers getting a pay bump in New York City. That includes Uber Eats drivers, right? Uber shares off 0.8% today. Domino's Pizza essentially flat. DoorDash jumped up 1%. JustEatTakeaway.com, which happens to be, in case you didn't know it, the parent company of Grubhub, slid 1.8%. Airfares are finally trending down. That's another tidbit from the Consumer Price Index. A couple of airline stocks then, shall we? Delta flew up 3.4%. Today, United Airlines also up 3.6% there. Bond prices went the other way, down. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus went up 3.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Inflation has been a global phenomenon the past couple of years. The pandemic, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you all know the basics. But not all inflation is created equal. Ours, as we talked about up at the top of the program, is coming down. Slowly, but coming down it is. Over in the UK, though, inflation is better than double what it is here, and it's not fallen anywhere near quickly enough. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has this transatlantic inflation update.
The UK's headline rate of inflation fell last month out of double-digit territory down to 8.7%. Good news, but not good enough. The decline was less than expected. Sushil Wadhwani, a former member of the committee that sets interest rates for the Bank of England, told the BBC that he now has a major worry about the UK economy.
That inflation is becoming embedded. That people are expecting inflation to stay high for longer. And that obviously is a dangerous development.
Dangerous because businesses that believe inflation will persist often put up their prices. Another factor pushing up prices here is a labour shortage, as fewer EU workers are available post-Brexit, and many British prime-age workers have simply quit the workforce. Ashley Webb of consulting firm Capital Economics says Britain's been hit harder by this labour shortage than many comparable economies.
Whilst the UK's labour force is still below its pre-pandemic level, in the US, the labour force is above its pre-pandemic level.
And with labour in higher demand, there's upward pressure on wages.
Wage growth is still much higher in the UK than it is in the US, and that's contributing as well to higher inflation.
As businesses pass on higher labour costs to their customers, and so the spiral begins. British workers have been demanding and getting big pay hikes because of the rising cost of living. Food price inflation here has hit a near 45-year peak. Paolo Bejarano Carbo is with the National Institute of Economic and Social Research.
The annual rate of food inflation in the UK is 19% in April, whereas the annual rate of food inflation was 7.7% in April in the US.
Some economists blame the UK's soaring prices largely on Brexit. But, says Bejarano Carbo, you can hardly claim that the rocketing price of food is due to the UK's departure from the European Union, when many European countries are suffering too.
The EU also saw an increase of above 19% in food price inflation in April.
The UK's overall inflation rate at 8.7% is around half a percentage point higher than the average for the EU. One reason for that, says Ashley Webb, is that some EU governments capped energy prices, a major factor in inflation, sooner and by more than the UK.
France intervened quicker and more assertively. That basically meant that the energy price component of inflation didn't rise as far.
Some economists, like Professor Patrick Minford, aren't worried about the UK's current inflation rate at all. He believes economic trends are moving in the right direction for the country.
The commodity price shocks are being reversed, and that's coming down the pipeline. And also, monetary policy has been tightened enormously. Fundamentally, I think the UK is a good economy.
But inflation rates do matter. Workers demand pay hikes on the back of them. And the fact that the OECD is forecasting that this year the UK will have the highest inflation rate in the G20, apart from Argentina and Turkey, doesn't exactly foster economic confidence. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The biggest auction of Western art in this country, the biggest but by no means the only, comes every year in the summertime when collectors descend on Reno, Nevada. Last year, 400 people shelled out better than $16 million for paintings of landscapes and cowboys and other images of the American West. Iconic, romantic to some degree, also corporate. Joni Kinsey is a professor of art history at the University of Iowa. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Could you describe the scene for me at one of these Western art auctions? What's the vibe?
The vibe is really rather overwhelming. It's generally a big convention center size hall with art all around the walls and a bar in each corner. Wow. People in very fancy Western wear, dripping with turquoise and so forth, big belt buckles. And several of them have these giant runways down the center.
Wow.
It's almost like a big fashion show, only people are buying the things that are trotting out in front of them.
So talk to me about those things that are being trotted out in front of them, the art itself, I suppose. I hope this isn't derogatory, but the phrase I came upon in my research for this interview is cowboy art. And that,
yes,
it seems to me, is not an accepted term of art. I don't know.
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. In the sort of Eastern art world, world art world, cowboy art is definitely not smiled upon. It's considered to be very kitsch. But in the Western world, and it's not just cowboys, definitely cowboys and Native Americans are very frequent images and subjects, but landscapes in particular also are basic subjects that you see at these Western art sales.
Where does this art come from sort of historically? I mean, obviously the expansion of the American West, Manifest Destiny, all of that, are the roots there?
Absolutely. Artists have been going west since not quite Lewis and Clark, but almost. Back in the 1820s, the first Eastern artists went west. And there have been several sort of variations on the trends over the 20th century and into the 21st. But the basic premise is still there, the romance of the Old West and all of the sort of mythological kinds of dimensions of that legacy.
Talk to me for a second about the railroads. Material, obviously, in the expansion of the West, but also in the development of Western art.
Absolutely. The story of the railroads and art is absolutely fascinating.
like many businesses, you know, images sell. A number of major railroads, most notably the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe, better known as the Santa Fe, but also the Great Northern, the Northern Pacific, were working actively with artists to get them to ride their trains out to premier destinations, especially the new national parks. So they became essentially the kind of forefront of, or sort of pioneers of branding, marketing and branding. And they built up some really major collections.
I read actually that Burlington Northern Santa Fe, which is the successor to Atchison Topeka, they've got like 700 and something pieces in their art collection.
Oh, it's more than that.
Oh,
it's
is it really?
More like 1,700.
Oh, my Lord.
But yeah, it's a remarkable collection.
So if it was the railroads that were prospering and profiting off of this art back in the day, who's profiting now?
All kinds of people are profiting now. Certainly the buyers that buy and then later sell that work. Certainly corporate businesses are also buying this stuff, especially in the West. And, you know, you can think about how else these works of art function. They add to people's thinking about region and about the West in particular, for good or for bad. And there's an awful lot of people invested in those ideas.
Yeah. Super quick, since you're the historian of American art here in this conversation, what do you think of this kind of art? Do you like it?
I have mixed feelings about it in some ways. I am a historian of traditional historic American Western art. And even that in some ways is problematic in regard to the way in which Native peoples, for example, not only were treated but depicted. The ways in which landscape itself was commodified and exploited. The more recent stuff is a little bit more problematic because it perpetuates some of those issues. But at the same time, it's a lively, extremely burgeoning realm of the industry. And it's kind of remarkable for its staying power.
Joni Kinsey is a professor of American art history at the University of Iowa. Professor Kinsey, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to talk to you.
This final note on the way out today, it comes in the form of a quiz. What do Corningware, Pyrex, Chicago Cutlery, and Instant Pot have in common? If you guessed they're all owned by the same company, which earlier this week filed for bankruptcy protection, well, maybe you should have this job instead of me. Instant Brands is the name of the company. Chapter 11 is the version of bankruptcy it's filing. That is reorganization, not liquidation. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Really, it's a marketplace nod to the news out of South Florida today. Inflation in the greater Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach area in April, which is the most recent month the Labor Department has data for, 9% over April a year ago. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mieten and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.